Coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Borax and Earthlitz, and welcome to the latest episode of the 2080 Thrillcast Lockdown Tapes. And first off, an apology for our complete absence last week, which was due to some rather major technical issues that got in the way and do also affect this episode. So, sorry about that, first off. This week we interview Roger Langridge and Brett Parsons, who the creative team behind Pandora Perfect, which was in last week's 2080 Regened. You can see why we had that all lined up. The quality on Roger's audio is very, very poor. Unfortunately, we've fiddled with it as much as we possibly can and can't get it to sound any better. So that's my second apology on this episode. We also talked to PJ Holden. Now, PJ is actually a bit of a bridging guest between last week's 2080 Regened and this week's Jumping On issue. We've got four brand new series brand new stories in this week's 2000 AD. We've got Adios Rowdy Yates by Chris Weston, who's written and drawn this one. We've got The Talented Mr. Chibsky, which is PJ Holden along with Kenneth Nymond. There's also Mechastopheles by Gordon Rennie, Lawrence Rennie, and Boo Cook, and Department K, which is another series from 2080 Regened that gets its own series in 2080 proper. That's by Rory McConville, Dan Cornwell, and O'Grady. Plenty of stuff into this particular episode. Again, sorry that we are a week late, but I hope you enjoy. Let's crack on start off by talking to Brett Parsons and Roger Langridge. Like I said, really sorry about the audio quality on Roger, but hope you can enjoy nonetheless. Well, thanks very much for this, guys. I really appreciate the opportunity to chat, because Pandora Perfect, the whole Regened project is something that has been, I don't want to use the word divisive, because that makes it sound like there's a war going on or something, but you know, lots of people have strong opinions about Regened. But Pandora Perfect is one of those series that appeared in a Regened last year, and immediately the reaction was, we want more of this. So what I wanted to do was just kind of drill down into the genesis of the strip and its kind of influences and everything. Because I guess it's exactly the kind of thing that a lot of people would expect when you talk about all ages, this kind of, you know, slightly anarchic, bit silly, a lot of fun kind of strips. Do you want to tell me a little bit about how this came together?
I was asked by the Mighty Thug to come up with something for the Regened arm of the magazine. And it was literally the first thing I thought of. I mean, there wasn't a whole lot of planning gone into it. I sort of had an idea that it should be something that people were familiar with, but like a twist on it. That made it seem like it was a little bit subversive or whatever. I don't know why I thought of Mary Poppins. I think maybe there had been the sequel of Mary Poppins out quite recently or something. It was just something that was in the air at the time. I like big stupid robots. It sort of came together overnight, really. I mean, I didn't really plan a lot of it. It's just sort of a lot of jigsaw pieces fell together in the right way.
So I do like the conceit, particularly in the latest story. No spoilers for anybody who's not read it yet. Pandora Perfect is basically Mary Poppins meets Catwoman, which is just wonderful. Just wonderful as a concept. So Brett, was this something that Tharg approached you about doing, or had you already worked with Roger before?
No, yeah, he approached me, and I hadn't worked with Roger, and it just, as soon as I read the script, it had a lot. I've been working on Tank Girl for the past handful of years, So it had enough of that same sort of ridiculous, absurdist, you know, vibe, but also toned down for a younger audience, which I liked. Like, I've got two kids now, so I've been enjoying doing little bits of all ages stuff here and there, and I'm, you know, hoping to do more of it. But so it was a nice mix of those two worlds, I thought.
Tell us a little bit about your style, because it it's perfectly suited to a story like this. What are your own artistic influences, but also when you were coming to do Pandora Perfect, were there specific things that you were drawing on?
I mean, I'm obviously influenced by people like Jamie Hewlett and you know, Don Bluth and animation stuff like that, but I think in the first script, Roger sort of described the world as being almost like Jetsons-like, like that sort of a future. And so then that got me thinking more of like the old Hanna-Barbera sort of animation designs, like Alex Toth's stuff and things like that, and just simplifying my style down a little more than it usually is and tuning it up a little bit. So I guess that's sort of where I came at it with.
I do like the fact that you mentioned the Jetsons, because that kind of pops off the page. Roger, was that kind of an early thing that you wanted it to look like, or was that once maybe you knew who was going to be drawing it?
I wrote the script without knowing who was going to be drawing it, actually. But Brett was sort of like one of the first people I thought of. Loved his stuff since I first saw it. He was doing Tank Girl for a while, obviously, and he did a couple of issues of The Goon just before I did a short run on The Goon as a writer. He was sort of coming out the door as I was walking in, you know. So I loved all the stuff I'd seen that he'd done, and I knew that he'd done something for 2000 AD before, so I knew that you guys had a working relationship with already. And yeah, he just seemed like a really good fit. And the Jetsons thing, yeah, I mean, I like that. I'm not doing hard science fiction here. It's you know, it's fantasy with nuts and bolts painted on the outside. And just, you know, generally you get away with that by just tweaking the aesthetic a bit, you know. And the Jetsons seemed like a good fit, you know. It's like a kid-friendly science fiction world, you know.
Let's just talk a little bit about humor comics and what that means for all ages stuff, because there's been a crisis, particularly in British comics, over the last 30 odd years about what comics are, what they can be, who are they for. Particularly for 2080, this has been developing into a kind of a slow motion crisis that, as the comic grew up with its readership, it was by its very nature less accessible to younger readers. What are your own thoughts on kind of all ages comics and efforts to recreate the industry that used to be there that was for kids?
I think 2000 AD is in not a very, you know, it's in an unenviable, unenviable position, because it's kind of the last man standing, you know. So it's got the weight of expectation of the entire industry on its puny shoulders, or well, not so puny perhaps, but you know, it's there's just so much expected of 2000 AD. It has to be all things to all people. So yeah, it's obviously in a very tricky position. Personally, I enjoy doing stuff that anyone can read, even if it's got like an adult subtext. I like to be able to show it to anyone and have anyone appreciate it on some level. And that's sort of part of the challenge of writing something for me, is to have it working on all those levels, to have jokes that only the parents will get, but also, you know, dumb slapstick that the kids are going to love. And juggling all those balls in the air is part of the fun for me. I do think when readership is sort of dwindling, it behooves one to make it as accessible as possible to as many people as possible, just so you're not closing too many doors.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of, like you say, having to be all things to all people does make it difficult to change and innovate. Brett, I mean, you said, you know, you're a father. With the all ages stuff, how do you as an artist translate that, what Roger was just talking about, into practice on the page? You know, where you've got a script that's full of little things that perhaps an adult would find funny, but it's still got to be accessible to kids.
I don't know. I think you just got to, like, I try to play it serious the whole way across, like play to both the adults and the kids, like he's talking about, because I don't know. You really do want to try to harvest as many new readers as you can while making the old readers enjoy it at the same time. So I don't know. I try to make it visually interesting, but also, I don't know, not too over the top. 2000 AD, like, the humor has always been such an integral part of all the strips, even Judge Dredd and things like that. It's always so, you know, tongue firmly in cheek at the same time as being, you know, intense too. So I think just by toning that down a little bit, it's more accessible to, you know, younger people as well, but you still have that same vibe, if that makes sense.
I think also with humor, if you're playing it straight, it tends to make it funnier, you know. That kind of Buster Keaton effect. If you do things deadpan, then it's a fight and it's a comedy. Whereas if you're overselling it, it can sort of kill it, you know.
Roger, you've got history with, 2000 AD, the magazine, from working on Straitjacket Fits back in the 1990s. And also, you did a bunch of work with the Muppets, didn't you?
Yeah. That was 2009 for a couple of years. Yeah, it was about 2 or 3 years worth of Muppet comics. Which is probably what people know me best for these days.
Are there the lessons that you learned from doing stuff, you know, like the Straitjacket Fits and like the Muppets, about how things can work on you know, how humor, how all ages stuff can work on the comics page?
I suppose it's sort of my instinct is not, you know, not to talk down. I'm trying to do stuff that I find funny, which is what all of my sort of all ages heroes have always done. People like Karl Barks or, you know, Basil Wolverton or Ken Reed or, you know, the Giants. But, you know, they're doing what makes them laugh. You know, just making sure that there's not, it doesn't involve, you know, too many bare bums or whatever, just to make sure it sneaks under the radar there. But, you know, it's like doing anything. You've got to do the kind of stuff you like, or otherwise, And you have to assume that you're not the only person who likes this stuff. If you're trying to second guess what an audience is going to want, then chances are you're going to get it horribly wrong.
I would like to talk briefly to you both about the cornerstone of all humor comics, particularly humor comics for kids, which is the fart. because this story is the Guff Warbler, which, you know, don't need to go into that too deeply. I kind of love how all those comics, kids comics, are just anarchic. You know, it's like, you mentioned Ken Reed there. There's that kind of, there is an anarchism to kids comics, like a transgressive quality to them. Is this something Brett, that you enjoy in, you know, doing fart jokes and you know, silliness and over the topness kind of thing?
Yeah, I'm usually up for whatever. I think living with two kids, it's definitely anarchy often. So that makes sense that children's material would be that way, I guess.
Because there's so many because looking back at like particularly British comics, like Dennis the Menace and the Bash Street Kids is just two examples. I mean, you know, it is a wonder that these things were ever allowed into kids' hands, because you know, whatever slippering they might have got at the end of the story just kind of pales into insignificance in comparison to the death and destruction. I mean, a perfect, you know, come back to Ken Reed, perfect example, Sweeney Todd-ler, a child who will surely be a serial killer later in life based on their behavior. I mean, Roger, what's your feelings on the nature of this kind of anarchistic madness?
It's what kids want to read, isn't it? I mean, if you do characters who aren't anarchic, who are sort of pretty good, the kids aren't interested in reading it. Even the ones who are quite, you know, responsible, even Harry Potter breaks the rules because that's the only way he can do what he has to do. And that's really attractive to a kid to want to break the rules. Or to test the boundaries, you know, that's part of growing up. That's part of a natural part of how a kid interacts with the world, is to constantly test boundaries. And to see on the page a kid who's doing that only, you know, tenfold, getting away with far more than they can ever do, is you know, this kind of wish fulfillment, I suppose. And, you know, the fact that it is all on paper and, you know, the writer has the option of letting it go just so far and no further. It's probably quite a good safety valve, you know. It's a way of kids experience all that stuff without actually, you know, pushing people into the street or something.
I mean, yeah, can you imagine the moral crisis that would envelop comics if that was the kind of thing they were teaching kids? I think this is... this is partly where a lot of the debate around things like Regine kind of comes, that, you know, 2000 AD, when it started, the humour was there. It was very black. It got blacker as it went along. And sometimes, I don't know, do you think that we can forget that kids want to have fun when they read stuff, you know, in our own kind of desire for, like, grim and gritty and nasty and the blackest humour possible, there is a place for levity?
I know, it's a bit like when you're growing up, you hit adolescence and you suddenly want all your stuff to be darker and sort of push things further and get into sort of what you consider to be quite adult areas. And then you pass through adolescence, you become an adult, and you think, actually, what I was desiring wasn't particularly adult. It was quite adolescent, really. It was you know, sort of teenage rebellion in a way, and actual adult stories involve things like making difficult decisions and doing the right thing when it's hard and stuff like that. And that's kind of, you know, you're out the other side of the grim and gritty stuff by the time you've reached adult, I think. And I think you're probably looking for a laugh, particularly if you've got a lot of responsibilities in your own personal life. You want an escape from that. You want something that's a little bit less, you know, angsty.
With Pandora Perfect, do you think that there's... Is she a character where... There's plenty more that, you know, there are lots and lots of adventures that you can take her on, because there is something about her character that rewards, you know, there's always a new challenge there for her.
I hope so. I mean, I've kept it fairly open-ended. In the first story, there's quite a few questions that haven't been answered, like where she got the bag and what its actual capabilities are and her particular relationship with Gort and how long they've been together, and, you know, and she's got, with this governess persona, a way of getting into practically anywhere. And she's, you know, very resourceful, and yeah, hopefully there's, you know, just the fact that it's so open-ended means that you can put her into any situation and, you know, just let her react to it and see what happens.
And Brett, in terms of drawing a series like this, did she kind of pop into your mind fully formed?
Pretty much. I mean, I think when I was approached about doing the first one, it wasn't long after I'd watched the old movie a bunch with my kids. And so that was kind of fresh in my head. And I, as I was watching that, I was thinking how beautiful Julie Andrews was. And so I tried to not stray too far. It was sort of a mix between Julie Andrews and Tank Girl, you know? And then with Gort, I wanted to make sure that he was a robot that I wouldn't mind drawing over and over again. So I tried to make him fun to draw, like a much more expressive face than a, you know, a block of metal or anything like that. Yeah. But I think the dynamic that Roger's created between the two characters really does lend itself to any kind of situation. Like just watching them sort of move in and out of this world is what's really entertaining.
It dawned on me that, because as I said, it's kind of Mary Poppins meets Catwoman. But also in this story, you've also got Jumanji in there as well, because you've got the stuffed animal collector. Is there just a particular joy in messing around with genre on something like this?
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, again, I was thinking of something that's like an institution that we can subvert. And I thought David Attenborough, there's no bigger institution than David Attenborough. Let's put a surrogate David Attenborough in there and just, you know, up to everybody's expectations of it. It was that or the Queen, and I thought maybe that was pushing it.
And I'm intrigued about how well this story has gone down, because, like I say, you know, there's some people who like the Regine stuff, some people who don't. But there was just something about this that clicked straight away. Can you think why that may be? You know, what quality is it? Just is it irreverence? Is it just fun? You know, what is it that made people go, actually, I really enjoyed this?
Well, hopefully, you know, it is fun to read. I'm sure the artwork had a lot to do with it, because that really made it pop off the page. You know, it was obviously colourful and engaging, and Brett's style is quite lively, you know, which isn't always, you know, there's a lot of very talented artists who, you know, are brilliant artists, but their work doesn't always have that kind of energy to it that Brett has. And I think the energy is probably a lot to it as well. Hopefully, you know, they find it funny. Hopefully the jokes are good. That's not my mistake. Yeah. Do we move it?
Brett, how this is purely kind of process question, but how do you get that kind of energy into a strip?
I don't know. I think when I'm working on a strip, I usually try to make it read as if there were no words. Like, that's my main concern, is like, if somebody looked at this and they didn't speak English, would they be able to figure out what's happening in the story through like body acting and facial expressions and stuff like that? I always get frustrated when you look at a book and something incredibly dramatic or incredibly weird or silly is happening and the people's faces don't emote what they're doing or saying, you know? So I think that's the first thing I always try to work on, is getting really authentic, you know, expressions suiting the mood. And yeah.
do you work, I mean, I can see the drawing board behind you. Do you work traditionally?
I kind of jump back and forth. Like, I'll do a lot of the penciling on a Cintiq and then print it out blue line and ink it and then scan it back in and color it. And with both these first Pandora stories, I did them all digitally, just because I was doing other books at the same time. So it was a bit of a time crunch. So I just inked it on the computer too. But if I can do it traditionally, I usually try to do that.
That's really interesting because from having talked to a lot of artists, they normally do pencils on, traditionally on paper, and then do their inks just because of the control that they can get with the inking tools and things like Manga Studio and stuff. So it's interesting that you're the other way around. Is there a particular reason for that?
I like that when you're drawing on the computer, it's very forgiving. Like if you want to resize something or tweak it or move it around or erase this, but save it for later in case you want to bring it back, it's very forgiving. And then I tend to pencil it really tight and then print it out. And then I'm just inking what I've drawn basically. So that's kind of, I find that relaxing as opposed to doing all the ditch digging.
Yeah, it's always interesting how artists integrate digital into their work and how much of a help or hindrance or kind of...
Yeah, it's such a help. It's amazing. It was mostly, I worked almost like 99% digitally for 3 or 4 years. And then I had no original art to show for it, like to hold in my hands. I just have these like files on a computer that could crash or get destroyed in a fire, So I started working traditionally again, just so I'd have stuff to show for it all that time or sell,
Because Roger, I mean, comics are a very different landscape to when you were working at the magazine, back in the 90s. In terms of the kind of stuff I keep bringing up the straitjacket fits, but that's because I enjoyed it at the time. In terms of your own career, what's the kind of primary differences now between then and the kind of work you're doing now?
I suppose that you're not going to get a long run on something these days, or you're not as likely to get a long run on something. I mean, people do, but it's these days the work I do tends to be lots of little projects going on at the same time rather than one thing that I'm doing for a long time. It's just the way the industry works now. I think, everything's kind of mini series and things that have got a specific length and graphic novels, that's kind of the industry now. So that's the biggest difference, I suppose. Also just, the way you get work now. When I started doing stuff for the magazine, it was literally me bringing my portfolio into the office and showing it to Steve McManus and sort of offering me work on the basis of a physical thing that I put in front of his face, and that, obviously that doesn't happen now. And a huge difference was the fact that I had to come from New Zealand to Britain to get work, whereas the internet has made that totally irrelevant now. Be anywhere in the world and it doesn't make the slightest difference. It's a very different landscape in lots of ways, I suppose. Those are the ones that pop into my head immediately, though.
And just thinking about the future, I know we've already touched on this, but has Tharg talked about more Pandora Perfect with you both?
We've got a 6-episode serial, which I've written. I don't know where Brett's at with that. I think he said he was going to be free in the summer, so that's probably coming up soon. There's going to be definitely more, and it's going to be a long story. I'm looking forward to that. Hopefully, if it's inveigled its way out of the redeemed and into the main thing, hopefully people will go for it. We'll see what happens.
Without too many spoilers about a thing, are you looking forward to diving into something that isn't that kind of little self-contained?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just about to finish up penciling the first one today and get that in. But it's been a nice breather from doing, I've been doing almost monthly comics for a long time now, and I just started to get really burnt out. So the idea of doing some fun all ages, 6-page stories every month is just really enjoyable.
Well, thank you very much indeed to Roger and to Brett. And again, apologies for the audio quality on there. Now, a guest who shouldn't really need that much introduction, PJ Holden. So it's quite a PJ heavy issue, this this Regenes.
It's the lockdown, post-lockdown weight gain. Shut up.
Because you've got Department K.
Department K, yes. Department K. Sadly, the last one I'm doing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you don't know. You don't know, not been told the news.
No,
I posted this on my blog this morning as well, but it's like I have been working for 2008, as you know, for about 20 years. I can count the number of things that have kind of taken off as good. I mean, I think I'm a good... I'm one of those guys you come in, I'm one of those batters that you pull in whenever you're, you know, a steady batter. I'm not going to knock it out of the park. I'm not going to get a home run, but I'm going to, you know, I'm going to steadily fill a gap there. And so I've had 20 years of kind of steadily filling gaps and doing stuff. And I think my work's good, but it's not, it's never going to go on, boof, exploded. And we did Department K, and Matt said, this is great, let's have some more of this. And I'd done Chimpsky, and Matt was going, this is great, let's have some more of this. And there comes a point where you go, oh, now there's two of them have taken off. I could only do one because I'm doing another thing as well. So I had to make a choice. It was a terrible choice between Chimpsky or Department K. And I'd already done Chimpsky with Ken. And so I kind of thought, I'm going to stick with Chimpsky. So basically, because Chimpsky and so this week's 2000 AD, which is the Regene Prog, has Department K in it. Essentially, it's the last one I'll be doing. And then I think next week, Dan Cornwall's taking over Department K. But Chimpsky is starting as well. So I think that was the problem. They were going to run concurrently. And I mean, maybe they weren't going to run concurrently. This was practically last year. I was running so far ahead at one point that things were happening a year ago. So, sadly, no, I'm not doing any more Department K. It's kind of heartbreaking because I'd sort of, Rory and I had batted lots of ideas back and forth and character designs and stuff about it. So it's as much a whole cloth idea as I've ever had to do for 2080, as much as a kind of designed all the characters. Chimpsky's slightly different because he comes from Dread's world already, so you've got all of that Dread stuff, and then he's a chimp, so he's not, you're not doing radical character design work there when you're designing a chimp. So the design work on that was like, there's a chimp. So that said, the series has got lots of other characters in it as well, so we'll see all of those guys too. So
I wanted to, we spend a lot of time sort of drilling down into each of the series, but I want to talk about your style because it's been interesting with the Regene stuff, seeing how Tharg has brought in artists with slightly cartoony styles, you know?
Yeah, kind of open, very open
style. Yeah, open and energetic and
friendly.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, there's lots of artists I love, but, like, you could never call Kev O'Neill's artwork friendly.
But I want to get your feelings on this, because as I talked with Brett and Roger, there can sometimes be this tendency to say, well, you know, if it was good enough for me when I was 8 years old, when I was reading, you know, Kevin.
Yeah, I mean, that's a weird look. I'm 51 this year, and I can honestly tell you there are things I liked when I was 10 or 11 that I don't think my 10 or 11 year old would like. You know, the kids change. The taste in what kids like is different now than it was 25 or 35 years ago. You can't, I don't think it'd be wise to present with exactly the same thing. That tastes are different, you know, and you've got to allow that. I mean, part of that, I think, as well, is very wide cultural stuff. So, you know, when I was a kid, it was black and white. Champion the Wonder Horse was on TV, for God's sake. So you know, that was as exciting as it got. Zorro was there as well. So comics were a colorful escape from all of that, and they were black and white. So now you can't present a kid who's got access to 24 hours a day anime and, you know, music all the time from Spotify and you know, Netflix on one click. You can't present them the same sort of stuff. It's got to be slightly different. And their tastes have kind of changed over time too. They're, you know, kids are more, again, when I was younger, I think the closest thing to anime there was Battle of the Planets, which we didn't call anime at the time, but that's become the sort of predominant way for kids into cartoony comic booky type things is that sort of anime manga style. And so you've got to sort of try and be not that, but you know, you've got to accept they're going to have different tastes, but also the artists are different as well. I mean, you can't use, I mean, I remember being at university and at university when I was in a drama society, and everyone, you know, people wanted to direct plays and things, and so they would stand up and say, I have a script here, I want to direct this. And some bright spark said, I think this whole organization, with this whole group, we should be doing a Shakespeare play, one every year no matter what. And it was like, but everyone's doing this voluntarily, and you can't force someone to make a thing if they don't want to make it. So you can't force an artist to go, right, you're taking the role of I don't know, you're doing Dave Gibbons in Rogue Trooper, that's what your job is. You know, we're different artists, so we're not going to draw the same way anyway, and kids have different tastes, and you've got to explore all of that. And so, and I think it's desperately unhealthy to say everything that kids get now should be the same thing I got when I was 10 or 11 or 12 or whatever. I have two kids that my oldest is 16, no interest in comics, never had an interest in comics. I couldn't make him interested in comics. My 12-year-old, really interested in comics, loves comics, and is only coming to some of the older black and white 2000 AD stuff after having gone to color and then gone to manga and then gone to those things. It has been a, you know, it's been an acquired taste for him. And so I think you've got to move with the times, man, you know. You've got to be different. You can't sit there and do exactly the same. Even if you did, I mean, I would hesitate to kind of accept the word of a 50-year-old that this is what kids want. So I don't know either. All I can tell you is that when I'm asked to draw a thing for the regime, I get kind of excited about the ability to maybe elasticate the artwork a bit more and to open it up a bit more, and to know that it'll be kind of funner. You know, it won't necessarily be visceral and gory, even though when I was a kid, visceral and gory was what I wanted to see. You know, it's not quite that. So I mean, it's a puzzle, because I don't think there's really good market research done by anyone. Nobody really knows. All you can do is do this stuff. And, you know, for 2000 AD especially, I don't think you can rely on the idea a kid's going to see it in the shelf and go, oh yeah, I'll take this out of the shop and buy it. I think 9 times out of 10, it's a hand-me-down. It's got to be an adult seeing it and giving it to a kid. I mean, when I was a kid, it was on the shelf. You'd take it home. You'd hope your parents wouldn't read it, you know. It's like the Channel 4 Red Triangle thing. You'd watch it with the blankets over and make sure no one knew it was happening. So there.
Well, that's an enduring image. Thanks.
It's burned into my brain.
But the thing with the Regine stuff is, you know, it is popular.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I mean, I know there's a few very vocal naysayers, right? So I think we've probably had this discussion before. I think while there can be quite a noisy group of people saying one thing or another thing, the vast majority of readers of 2080 are generally, no, I don't want to say passive, but generally pick it up, read it, and then move on. They're not sort of in, you know, they don't stake their life around it. They don't spend any more time thinking of it maybe than a commute into work or whatever. And there may be quite a lot of people that just read it and never correspond with the magazine in any way. I mean, certainly, again, when I was young, I would have read it, but I never once wrote a letter. I never once sent a drawing in. For me, it was a passive, I get this, oh my God, what's in this, you know? So I think that's still true for a lot of readers. So you've got to, I think it's the hardest job for maybe Matt is to kind of not be swayed by that noise, because that noise could take you down a direction. But you've got to be aware that just because a noisy contingent say one thing, it doesn't make that true. It certainly might be true for them, you know, for that group. But, you know, as I think, I mean, I don't know, I can only read the tea leaves in terms of the general hubbub, but it seems to be generally popular. I think the numbers are quite good on it, as far as I know. I don't know, you'd have a better idea than me. And so it suggests that the noisy group are wrong. You know,
it's one of those things that, you know, everyone has their own tastes, but ultimately it is an anthology.
Yeah.
There's always going to be stuff that you're not necessarily going to get. You know, some people say, well, why can't I opt out? It's like, well, actually, that's far more complicated than you could possibly imagine.
Yeah, that's a nonsense. I did see somebody suggest that. I felt like kind of sorry for them, because I could see the answer a mile off, which was, you know, I mean, where does that begin and where does that end? You know, at what point do you say, look, I'm only getting this if John Wagner's writing the Dread. I'm only getting, you know, it's there for you to pick up off the shelf whenever you want it, and it's there for you to get the thing. But I want to be surprised. I mean, this is a thing I've said frequently before, is if I get 2080 and there's something that I hate, I'm really viscerally hate, and that was true in the 90s more than now, that's for sure. I would still quite like that I hate it. I would still quite like that there's something in there that is not to my taste at all, because it means somebody else is getting something out of it. You know, it's unlikely that everyone hates it. Someone's going to love it. So, you know, and sometimes the stronger feeling stuff is probably better, you know. But I also think as well that maybe, I mean, when you do anything new with anything, you do anything new, you don't know what the audience is going to be like. And you've got to allow yourself a chance to refine what it is you're doing. So it might take you a few goes to get it exactly what you want. It might take you a few goes to find the voice that you're looking for it. And I think that might be true of the Regained. I think it may well be that the Mighty Tharg has decided this is, we want this to look like this. And it's only in the kind of the doing of it over a number of issues that you start getting that shape. Because you can't, I mean, I think it's one of the hardest jobs is being the editor of an anthology title, where you go, I have a vision in my head of what this might be. And then you ask your creative teams to do that, and they're all going to go off and do different things. I mean, it'd be like taking 1,000 ants and pouring on the desk and just pouring them on the desk saying, I want the Eiffel Tower, and just pouring them down there and seeing what they do. And then at the end going, kind of like the Eiffel Tower. I don't know. So it's kind of a hard job. I mean, you're kind of herding cats in some ways to get. So I think over time, as we see more issues of the Regened, and as the Regened feeds in on itself, and as the creative teams, and I like that it's been a way for Matt to bring completely new voices into 2080, and voices that I would have said, I remember doing portfolio reviews, and general consensus was, if you're cartoony, you have no hope. You know, if you're a cartoony artist, yes, there's been a couple of cartoony artists, but few and far between. If you've got that kind of voice, forget it, you know. And I think the Regened's opened that up, opened that door a bit wider, which I actually think has opened that art style wider for the readership as well. So you see that in works that people have gone, this is great, let's see it in the 2080 proper. You know, and it's not even so much that they're going, I like that this is a story for children, I want to see it in 2080 proper. It's more that, well, I like this art style, or I like this story, or whatever it is, that has a slightly different taste or texture to it than what 2080 normally would be. I would always say, I think, certainly I'd always say, I don't know what 2080 art style is, but I know what it isn't, and it's not that, or it's not this, but it's allowed the kind of the stretching of that definition of what is acceptable in 2080 to open up a bit, which is good. Good for the magazine, I think. You know.
Well, let's talk about Chimpsky, which is done with Ken Nymond. And again, a very popular new character who's bought something.
Yeah, it's one of those things. I don't know how it works, right? So I don't know if Matt is sitting there and Chimpsky issue comes out and he's deluged with emails from people saying this is great, or if he's sitting there and there's just a general vibe in the room where everyone goes, do you know what, I quite like Chimpsky, but I don't know quite what it is because I've never experienced it before. But somehow the feedback was, we like Chimpsky, let's do more. That was similar feedback to Department K, which is, we like Department K, let's do more. It definitely came from Matt asking for more, but whether Matt, you know, whether it was just Matt deciding he likes that, or whether it was kind of a vibe elsewhere, but it's one of those things that sort of felt it's like, because you're sitting in your room all the time, you know, like you're just sitting here working. You're not talking to anyone. You do your work, and then 6 months later, the work gets published, and then feedback slowly dribbles in, and it's like you've got a hit in your hands, and you're going, "Oh, I drew it 6 months ago, so it's I'm weirdly disconnected from it, but yay, it's a hit." So it's good. So I'm glad he's broken out. I mean, to me, he's what I like about the character is that he is a section of Mega City One that we don't see. It's a positive. It's a kind of stories that sort of end quite well. They end with a, you know, it's not just Dread punching someone and now this is another terrible thing that's happened. It's, do you know what? There's a chink of light in this world. There's a chink of light that, and Chimpsky is kind of in there and sort of making it, you know, making the world slightly more positive and livable. I think, especially in the world that we live in now, that's not a bad thing. You know, that a positive character that has stories that end in a sort of positive note, or at least in an end with a character that has a moral heart and has an ethical heart. And you know, Dredd has, Dredd as a character has a code of ethics and a code of morals, but they're not the code of ethics and morals you and I would have. You know, they're the law. In essence, it's the law. Whereas Chimpsky is more kind of, look, that might be the law, but that's not right. You know, and that's what I really like about the character. So it's fun to do it. I mean, we're taking our first series is taking Chimpsky well out of Mega City One, though. He is kind of going to find himself in space and dealing with the deep and dark history of a deep, dark and horrific history of how apes became intelligent in Mega City One. So, which is in itself, it's sort of interesting. I think there have been little stories that have touched on that, but this brings us to this one character. So,
because it's very easy, and I've seen people do this, to make comparisons to Chopper, as you know, a Chimpsky's character that has bested Judge Dredd without resorting to the same kind of paradigm of violence that it has. But there's something new about Chimpsky, and I think. Chopper was very much a product of the kind of anti-Thatcher anarchism that Alan Grant especially was very much into his anarchism in the 1980s that evolved into more objectivism as the decade went on. So it's all about the individual. It's all about, you know, how does the individual stand against this kind of tyranny? And for Chopper, that was very much about, well, he's not going to play Dredd's game. You know, he's going to live his own life. He's going to reject authority and hierarchy and, you know, the way he's told his life has to be. But with Chimpsky, there is that same kind of anti-authoritarianism about the character. But as you say, it's much more focused to how do I help those around me, not just myself, but how do I?
I think Chopper is a character I think is like a big two fingers up to the system. It's someone raging at it and going to hell with this. I'm not taking this anymore, and I'm going to bring it all down. And never can do it. Can never do it. You know, the best Chopper can ever do is escape justice and find his own way. Chimpsky is much more, I think, a character is going, I am living in this unlivable system, but I'm going to make it as good as I can for me and for everyone around me. And I think philosophically, that's more where I am. You know, you can't change with the best will in the world, I can't bring down a government, but I can, you know, I can help my neighbor. I can sort of, treat people around me with respect and treat people around me well. Like, I don't need to make a big fuss about all of that. And in some ways, getting away with small acts of kindness is I think for Chimpsky's characters, maybe it's a longer term strategy, a better long term strategy when you're living in a dystopian future than trying to bring down the system, which will inevitably crush you. I think, it can never not crush you. Dredd's world, in the same way that Dredd turned up in a story, can never be resolved with Dredd being killed. You know, it's always going to end with you being smacked in the face and Dredd stomping all over you. I think the interesting things are that when Chimsky does get involved in a Dread story, there's never really a direct confrontation between the two of them. There's never a kind of, I'm bringing you down. Chimsky at best kind of stays under there. And I don't think people quite realize that as far as Dread is concerned, I think there's been some, Dread's stumbled across Chimsky a couple of times now. Why doesn't he remember the ape? It's like, because is he a chimp? He can't tell one from the other. I mean, Dredd is not a great human being. He doesn't have instant recall. As far as he's concerned, it's an underclass and he doesn't see him, I think anyway. I mean, that's how I've come to interpret it. And I think for Chimsky, it is just about getting on and trying to help people as best as he can. I mean, I suspect as he's a savant and he's super smart and he can see that the writing on the wall is that, this system cannot be changed in any way. There's no big, there's no Jenga block I can pull out here that will bring the whole thing tumbling down. There's nothing I can do here. What I can do is make lives better around me. And I think that's the kind of philosophical stance. Now, having said all that, I'm not the writer, and Kenneth Newman might well decide, I have decided he's going to bring down Dredd's world, but that might be a story for another day. But for me, it's just if you were smart and living in Megacity One, would you be Chopper or would you be Chimsky? I think I'd be Chimsky. I mean, I've got the hairy arms and the short stature, so
I'm not going to make any comment there.
No, thanks very much.
the whole thing about Regened and Department K, they're Dredd World stories. They're kind of the expansion. The man himself is noticeably from these narratives. Do you think that's that allows? I mean, we're talking about with Chimsky an ability to still comment on. And have in the background that element, that kind of satirical element that always has to be there for Dredd.
I don't know. I mean, I think the thing is, Dredd and Megacity. So Dredd the character, I think, is one thing. So you've got Dredd himself, then you've got Megacity One, and the whole world, and this, and the effectively the universe, which is as big as a Star Wars universe. It's everything. It's all in there. And I think if you're going to do a story that is satire in Dredd's world, why not do a Dredd story? If you're going to do something without Dredd, find some other area to explore. And I think that was part of the idea between Rory and I just kind of talked about with Department K is, what have we not seen in Dredd's world? Which element of it have we never really explored? And what have we not done there? So it was never kind of, let's do satire, let's do this kind of satire, that kind of satire, because I mean, Dredd's got that covered, if that's his baby essentially. But for us, it was like, for me certainly, it was like, well, let's do this. If we take them and do multi-dimensional stuff, that's something I don't think we've seen much in Megacity One. Judge Death establishes there are different there's a multiverse out there. So we know there's a multiverse out there, but Death is a commentary on Dredd, and it's a satire on Dredd and so on. It's a kind of natural extension of where you go with a Judge Dredd character. So, but let's explore it in another way. It was very deliberately, let's explore Kirby imagery, let's explore that kind of Jack Kirby big universe thing, and let's do it with the lexicon of Dredd's world. So it allows us an easy in for the reader. This is a tech department in Mega City One. Okay, I understand all the basic rules then. I understand, what the laws are, who they are. I understand that they've got access to certain technologies. I understand all of that. And then it was like, and now let's play. Let's go out as far as we can and play with that a bit. And I think it was me that suggested to Rory the idea. We were talking about what I wanted to draw. And it was like, I want to draw, like Kirby does these giants, these kind of the celestial giants. Let's do something like that. Just to, for fun, it was just, let's do that for fun. And so that's kind of how we ended up with these characters. I was like, well, what are we going to do with them that's slightly different? And so I suggested to Len O'Grady that we color them in such a way that they look like they're shimmering, like they're constantly vibrating. And so that's kind of how they appeared. And so I think when it came to the second one, I think Matt had other plans in terms of, I mean, there's still, I don't think we have ever had really a title that focuses on a tech department, tech judges. And, you know, there's a lot of ground you can cover in there. That's good fun. I mean, we have, of course, the time machine. Yeah, so there's a tech department with a time machine. So what's the tech department doing all day? You know, what are they doing every single day? They've got a time machine in the cupboard. What else have they got? You know, we never see it because we're too busy out with Dread. And I think sometimes the it's very easy with Dread to start grinding down towards reality, to start kind of making it more and more a commentary on the real world. And so you end up with kind of more humans in it than aliens and robots. And yet all these things exist in Dread's world, these very strange aliens and very strange robots and stuff. You know, I mean, how, for example, do you, you know, enforce a law when an alien might be a kind of cloud, you know, a cloud of information floating in front of you, and you want to do them for jaywalking? You know, we never get stories like that because Dread's always kind of commenting on the real world. And so you don't get those truly sort of weird alien things, but they're all in it. They're all part and parcel of it. You know, there's a Pandora's box of stuff in Dread's world that when you open, you can play with all sorts of things. So I think the Matt had sort of suggested that we bring the judges back from dimension hopping back to their home base and then can go back out from there. So that's kind of why the second one, they essentially, we see them kind of hopping from one universe to another and coming back. And I'd suggested various things, but with Rory kind of essentially me not doing the rest of it now. So I want Dan and Rory to have a full run at whatever they want to do. You know, it was going to be a great playful area for me as an artist. Boo. But now it's Dan and Rory's turn to have fun with that. So, yeah, I mean, I do think, like, Dread's World has, we've had stories covering the space judges that are all about the space judges and kind of have a in the far distant future, there is only grim war kind of feel to them. But Dread's World is massive. You know, I think there were the law judges as well. There was the law conjurer, if you remember that. I think it was different alien species or it might have been different dimensional alien species in one big law convention and stuff. And it's all of that is sitting there in a box waiting to be played with, you know. But because Dread has to be about Dread stories, you're always kind of going, well, Dread wouldn't really be out there dimension hopping. And it's very unusual for him to be doing that. So we've got to stick with Dread and see what those Dread stories are. So Department K has a chance to play out in a bigger universe than maybe even Dread gets to. But the one thing I would say they should steer away from is satire, because I think that's Dread's thing, you know. I mean, that's not to say it can't be funny, which it can, of course.
I like the idea of you say about the tech division, that they've got all these incredible toys, but all they spend their days doing is just making bigger and bigger weapons.
Yeah.
No, put the time machine down, make this gun bigger.
Yeah. Yes, this is. I mean, I used to work in tech, as you know, in IT, and I would, you know, someone would say to me, "So have you got this? This printer wasn't working," and I would turn up and go, "Let me tell you what happened, right? So the IP address for that printer was reset whenever you switched everything off," and I could see their eyes glaze over, and I would just imagine that would be the same with Dread. Dread would go, "I need something to deal with this giant blob, a vampire alien. Have you got a gun?" And they're going, "Ah, now that's an interesting question, because I don't want to know." But at the same time, I want to hear the story about why that gun was made, you know, why that gun wasn't really a gun. It was an accident. And then suddenly it became a gun. You know, there's all these little areas that can be played with and sort of teased out a bit, you know. So I still hope it's kind of kid friendly. I've seen some of the artwork. Dan's artwork looks lovely on the next series of it. So I kind of hope that, because my son really likes the Regine probes, I always hand them over to him, say, "There you go, kid." And so I kind of hope that's a strip he can read on. And also turn to me and say, "Daddy, I prefer his art," because that's the kind of cruel child I raised.
You deserve no less.
I know.
Brilliant, brilliant. Well, great start to both series. So looking forward to how they...
So Regine, the Department K is this week. And then I think that Chimsky is next week, starts next week with a cover, which I extra oil rations to whoever came up with the cover. I did the cover I did is basically based on the cover, on the poster for Vertigo. the film Vertigo, and it's kind of symbolic of Chomsky falling towards a kind of there's a door's been pulled open and Chomsky's been sucked out of this door in a vacuum. I thought this would be a fun thing to do. It'd be like, I could do like a Vertigo poster kind of thing. And it might have been Matt, but someone in editorial came up with Plummet of the Apes, which I think is genius.
Ex-Royal Russians for that droid. But lovely. thanks, PJ. Looking forward to seeing how they both go.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much indeed to PJ for chatting again on the podcast. And looking ahead, the talented Mr. Chomsky is certainly one to keep your eye on. So we shall be back in a fortnight's time. Again, apologies. But next week, we're going to be hearing a vintage episode from the Thrillcast, which is Steve Yoel. Now, this is the old two-parter, which we're going to mash together into one nice long chat. So, those of you who don't know Steve Yoel, I mean, what are you playing at? Artist on Zenith. He's been the artist recently on Sinister Dexter. So many other thrills. So it was great to be able to revisit that particular episode from back in the early days of the 2008 Thrillcast. So until next time, Earthlitz. Fingers crossed, we'll see you in a week's time. And until then, take care of yourselves. Enjoy the good weather and splendid Vertrig.
Alert! 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 Full power levels dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Read 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com.